And welcome to Thrift Shop Biography. This is the one about George Michael. Thank you for listening. Hello.
Hello.
How are you?
Very good. How are you?
All right, thanks. So this week I was lucky enough to find it in the thrift shop, the original autobiography of George Michael. And I was so pleased to find it because I know, like, on eBay, this is worth like £100. Amazing. And I got it for £1.
Somebody didn't know what they had. Yeah, we've had to share this one and swap books, haven't we, this week?
So we should say, full disclosure, we've already done the book written by Andrew Ridgeley, who was George Michael's partner in the pop band Wham. It was one of the first episodes we did, right?
Yeah, it was.
And that's a modern book that was written in the last few years, and it was about himself, George Michael, and Wham. This autobiography was written 30 years ago.
Yeah, it's written about 1990,
91. Mm-hmm. But interestingly, it's missold because it's actually not just an autobiography by George Michael. Andrew Ridgeley's voice is in this, his manager, his publisher, Shirley from Wham.
It's one of those, again.
A collage of voices.
Yeah.
I mean, it's thoroughly interesting, but it's not just George Michael's voice coming through in this book. In fact, even the writer, normally a ghostwriter, actually writes full passages in this book as well, filling us in on his history.
Yeah, there's no ghost in it. Yeah, he does. He puts social context to it.
Yeah.
He analyses the music. I didn't think I didn't need that. I know the music inside out.
Yeah.
You don't have to describe it to me.
So we did Andrew's book like a year ago. So I think it's time to go back in and look at George.
Also, we just wanted to hear his point of view.
Yeah. And also, we should say, of course, that even though this is an autobiography and George is telling us his truth, this is before he came out as a gay man.
Mm.
So there's a bit of conflict here because obviously we know different things were going on and that's not coming across in this book.
As in he's not telling us the truth.
Yeah, but I almost think beyond that, there is truth in this book. I don't think we rewrite the whole thing off because he's not saying
no,
he's gay.
No, there is definitely truth in this book.
And I think there's ambiguity when he talks about relationships, actually. Sometimes he talks about women.
Oh, yeah. If you just switch that in with he instead of she, that's still some truth.
But then, I mean, we'll get to the women and we can discuss them then. But just to remind me, because the last time I asked you was a year ago, I know the answer to this. Were you a Wham fan?
Wham fan!
Oh, what about a George Michael solo fan?
Yeah, I've got most of his albums.
Have you?
Yeah, I loved them both. Never saw them live, though. How about you?
Loved Wham. Have to say that I kind of think the George Michael solo career was perhaps a bit too mature for me.
Yeah, it was too mature for me, but I listened anyway.
He got a bit dad rock towards the end, didn't he?
Oh, towards the end. I mean, okay, when you get into stuff like Fast Love and Outside, massive fan.
Oh, I went right off it.
I love those songs.
Really?
Oh.
I think they're too slick R&B for me. I like Wham.
Yeah. Yeah, anyway, yeah, I followed him, yes, all the way.
Yeah, oh, I'm a Wham fan. Anyway, we should just get into
it.
We're going to talk too much.
Yes.
George Michael was born, I'll let you pronounce this.
Oh, thank you. Yorgos Panayiotou.
In
1963.
In North London.
Finchley, yeah, North London.
Round here.
Around here he was.
And George Yorgos has got two older sisters, Yoda and Melanie. I mean, I'm presuming that Yoda is pronounced differently in Greek. She can't be called Yoda.
Could it be Yoda?
It could
be. Let's say Yoda.
And Melanie.
Yes.
And their dads come over from Greece.
Well, they were Greek Cypriots.
Okay.
They were Greeks living in Cyprus. They said at that time, it was quite touristy, you either were a farmer or a fisherman, or you were a waiter or a tailor. His dad was a waiter, came to London, got a job waiting, and worked his way up over the years to own his own restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
It's a quick way of saying that story.
Yep.
George Michael actually says that's the true legendary story we should be talking about, is that man's life, because that's amazing.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's true. That's how it starts.
And his dad was a good-looking young man, right?
Yeah, he was.
He even got into the local paper, like in this heartthrob competition, and got voted right up to the end. And in fact, I think they hid this clipping from George for a long time because they didn't want to encourage his aspirations of being like a pop star.
Yeah.
And when George found it, he was really impressed.
He did look great. His mum looks great.
Oh, the photos in the book, they're a nice-looking couple,
yes,
aren't they?
And they met dancing, so it's in the family.
And they just had a modest life in a semi-detached house. Like you say, his dad was a grafter building up his restaurant.
Yeah, and it got gradually better and better till they lived in a nice house.
Yeah, they moved to a big house.
In Bushy.
Bushy.
Which is a little known town on the outskirts of Watford.
So we can cut a long story short because we have covered a lot of this in the Andrew Ridgeley episode. But basically, once they moved to Bushy, he went to a new school and another young lad was assigned to look after the new boy. And that young lad was Andrew Ridgeley. Young George, when he meets Andrew, Andrew is the athletic, confident, good-looking one.
Yeah.
And George just feels a bit kind of podgy and frumpy,
yes,
next to him. But he latches on to Andrew's confidence and charisma,
yeah,
doesn't he? George's family. So George would take friends home. But when he befriended Andrew and started taking Andrew home, his family didn't like him because Andrew was just too cocky. George said that Andrew was kind of already famous in a sense at school. It's like everybody knew who he was. And he actually said the kids with the darker complexions were racially bullied. But he said Andrew seemed to transcend that. And he was just completely popular with everyone.
Yeah.
He was like the star of their
year. Like a child star, he said.
Yeah,
almost.
Which I think is good for George because George is quiet and shy. And we find out through this book, actually, how reluctant he is. I think there's a real battle going on between George about this person,
yes,
who does enjoy being screamed at, but at the same time just wants to retreat.
Yeah, well, that's, you know, if we're finding the core of this person's problems, it is exactly that.
Hey, this
is an identity crisis all the time.
It's like Britney Spears, but when she was a kid, she loved singing and performing, and she also liked hiding in a wardrobe.
That's so true.
Yeah, it's a similar thing.
Yeah.
And she's not been without her problems.
No, she hasn't.
Yeah.
Well, he said at some point he just didn't even want to go out because he'd look in the mirror and this person that everybody thought they knew, he couldn't see them. He only saw the kid. He saw the spotty, shy, ugly kid.
Yeah.
And he constantly said he felt like a fraud.
Yes.
Once he got popular. So I think he just is stuck feeling like this kid.
One of the first sentences in this book is, "I used to feel like a fraud."
Mm.
Amazing, huh? Because we knew him in Wham. My God, they were both seemingly so entirely confident, dancing around, singing, so good looking, so charismatic. Amazing now to read that that young man. That's another thing. Because we were kids and they were pop stars, we forget how young they were.
I know, they were so, what were they, 17?
Yeah, when Wham started
when it
get
started.
Going, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was astonished by how young they were.
But see, when they started out, he didn't feel like a fraud because he knew what he wanted. He wanted to become massive in terms of a band.
Yeah, in terms of songwriting and being a musician. Yeah,
yeah. And he knew what he had to do to get there. It was only once they got there that he started feeling fake.
Mm-hmm. So at school, Andrew had the popularity and George was musically talented. He was already writing songs and stuff, and there was a bit of a trade-off already in that George would latch on to Andrew's popularity, and George really encouraged Andrew in his musicality.
Yeah.
So it's a good exchange they had going on. And then that seminal movie at the end of the 1970s,
yes,
Saturday Night Fever, came, and that whole scene changed their lives.
Yeah, it really did, didn't it?
They said it wasn't just the film.
Well, disco's piped up after that, and George wouldn't even dance before that film came out.
Yeah.
It kind of gave permission for men to dance and for it to be cool for men to dance. Before that, he said he had 3 records at home, 2 Supreme records and 1 Tom Jones record.
Good records to have.
They're really good.
Even if you have to play them on heavy rotation.
I can hear the Supremes definitely through his,
in his
influence.
Well, yeah. There's a real Motown beat to some of those early Wham singles, definitely. And I guess Tom Jones, you know, when George Michael is singing a ballad, he does have that balladeer voice. I guess Tom Jones has too.
Yeah.
So they're 14 and they're dancing and they're already working out routines in the front room.
Yeah, I love that. Because I thought it was something that only us kids did. If you watch those early Top of the Pops, it's so simple. Which is why it's so great for kids, because we can copy it. Mm-hmm. Actually, I think 80s dancing was pretty simple, wasn't it?
So George also had this friend called David Austin. Did you know about David Austin beforehand?
Probably from Andrew's book, but
yeah, he had like a minor hit in the 1980s, and I knew he was friends with them, but I didn't realize they'd all started off in a band together. Again, so there was a few of them doing music together, like Andrew's brother, who I also think was called David or Stephen or Andrew. No, he's called Andrew. Paul. He had one of those names. But I think that proves that Wham, the personalities of George, Michael and Andrew Ridgeley were just as important as the music. Because I was thinking, if George Michael had gone off with David Austin, Wham might never have happened. It's a coming together of George and Andrew which really made Wham
they
happen.
They were so bonded. I mean, they absolutely loved each other. They were really hooked on each other. Because Shirley says it, the girlfriend of Andrew, and then just completely loves them both and ends up being the backing singer. And she says, I think that's the reason it worked so well as a threesome, because there's no way I could have ever prized Andrew away from George anyway. So the only way was to join them. So really, really bonded.
I loved having Shirley's voice in this book.
Yeah, it's nice.
Yeah, because we've only ever heard from Andrew and George before. Well, George now. In fact, Shirley is the only person who could give us a genuine perspective, first-hand account of their relationship, because she was part of the threesome.
Yes.
I actually think she's been forgotten by history a bit, because you know how the Andrew Ridgeley book made me realise how important he was to Wham?
Yes.
This book actually has made me realise how important Shirley was in the beginning of Wham, those dance routines and having the girls in. Were it not for her, I don't think they'd have had girls in at the beginning.
True.
Which would have changed the dynamic, you know.
Someone had to mind that. Couldn't have been Andrew.
When we read Andrew's book, I was sad for the woman who actually, the session singer, who actually sang the lines that Shirley mimed on Top of the Pops. Now, reading this book a year later, I feel a bit sorry for Shirley. I think she's kind of been left behind a bit. I think she should be recognised as more of an important part of Wham than she is.
Yeah. Do you not think she is, though? If you see any documentary, she's always in it. She's in these both these books.
Yeah, but I think they pushed her to the side quite early.
Yeah, it does seem like they did.
She's only visually in the first four videos. Is she in Last Christmas video? I don't think she is.
No, and she feels terrible for being in the Club Tropicana. Says she was voguing. She wasn't dancing. She was walking around as a glamorous air hostess. I think she was great. I don't see the problem.
She felt uncomfortable because she wasn't dancing. Yeah.
They were just blobbing about in
budgie smugglers.
Yeah.
So anyway, I would just like it on record that Shirley Holliman was a very important part of Wham as we know it.
Yes.
The early days.
That's very good.
Yeah. So the schoolboys have all made this little band together called The Executive. Yes. They do a few gigs and...
like four.
Yeah, it comes to nothing quite quickly. It kind of disbands. I think David Austin goes off and tours Thailand with another band. George and Andrew continue with a couple of older musicians, but it doesn't quite gel or work out. And then George and Andrew realise, oh, we should just do this as a twosome. And they hang out and they write songs in George's bedroom. But this is like Careless Whisper and Wham Rap.
Yeah.
They're like young teenagers and they are writing classic songs.
Yeah, we're still singing to this day. But George says, I remember exactly where I was when Careless Whisper basically played itself inside my head. It was the sax line. And he sat on the bus. He remembers it starting off. And I kept it there and I worked on it in my head for 3 months. And then eventually I put it out and Andrew put some guitar chords on it. That's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah. So they start making a demo tape and George actually at the same time, he's a DJ in a restaurant. Now, was that an 80s thing?
So embarrassing.
Yeah, he didn't enjoy doing it.
It must have been an 80s thing because I don't think I've ever been aware of that.
I've never been to a restaurant where there was a DJ.
Don't need one.
Sometimes you get a flamenco guitarist.
Actually, no. Some of the Indian restaurants in Birmingham used to have DJs, but then they turned into sort of a big dance night at the end.
I get the impression they clear the tables and then you can have a hoedown.
So it'd be like, you know, those sort of package holiday type of situation where it's a whole night out. Oh my God.
But George had this job and he hated it. But he said on his last night, and he knew he was leaving, at the end of the night, he played Careless Whisper before anybody had ever heard it. And he said everybody came up and danced to it. Yeah. I'm imagining a slow, smoochy dance.
Yeah.
He knew it was a hit anyway. Yeah. But seeing the response of the people on the dance floor gave him real confidence in his demo tape.
He sat on that song for a long time because it only came out with the second album. And it's a good job it did, else it wouldn't have earned a bugger all. But we'll come to that.
We'll come to that. Yeah. So they had this demo tape and they did this real thing of Andrew's confidence is carrying them through. They're basically going in to record company headquarters and saying, oh, we have an appointment. They didn't have an appointment. And he said half of the time it worked. People just said, oh, okay. And they would go in, they would put the tape in the player. And as soon as it started, no, thank you. Anyway, it turns out in the Three Crowns pub, a guy called Mark Dean used to drink in there, who was a local man who had very recent success. He had discovered Soft Cell and ABC. Yeah. I mean, they're possibly the two biggest bands of 1981, I would say.
Yeah, yeah. They call him the Berry Gordy of Bushy.
That's a great title to have. And Andrew, you know, cocky as he is, goes up with the demo tape and gives it to Mark Dean, who actually CBS, because of his recent success, CBS have just given him his own record label called Inner Vision, and he's looking for new talent. And he's approached by Andrew Ridgeley, who gives him the demo tape. And Mark Dean just instantly likes it.
Yeah, loves it. Yeah. Can I tell you this? Since we read Andrew Ridgeley's book, I went to the Three Crowns, not on purpose. I went there, actually, sadly, it was for a funeral. And somebody said, do you realise this is a Wham pub where they got their first in with the music industry? I said, what are you talking about? Said, they used to hang out here. In fact, they used to hang out in the snug around the corner there because they were underage. And so they liked to hide away just so that they didn't draw any attention to themselves. So they were always down here. So this is their corner. And then when Andrew Ridgeley launched his book, he did it there at the Three Crowns. Wow. And there's photos of him in the corner. It's called Wham Corner. Isn't that cool?
Yes.
So I actually can picture this exactly. Carry on.
So Mark Dean signed them. They got a £500 advance each to be paid back through royalties. They got 8.5% on single sales, 6% on album sales, and 0% for 12-inch singles, which were at their height in the first half of the 1980s.
It is the worst contract you've ever heard of. Not only that, because I've read this a couple of times, so I was a bit confused because it's all legal stuff, but it seems like CBS only allotted Mark Dean a really small percentage of the overall profit anyway, from which he was paying them those percentages.
Yeah.
So it's piddling. When Fantastic was number one everywhere, they were getting about 50 quid a week and living at home. Absolutely terrible.
That's a rock and roll business for you.
Yeah. But they'd gone off and signed this contract in a greasy calf. They were 17. And George Michael said more than once in this book that people say, why were you so pleased this contract was so bad? And he said, no, you've got to understand. It's because it was so bad that we could get out of it. Because, you know, you take that to court and it's laughably bad.
Mm-hmm.
So of course it gets broken. Although these lawyers had to really, really fight to get them out of it because it's still a signed contract.
They also sign with a publisher at this point. Interestingly, they don't have a manager for ages.
Yeah.
They have the publisher, Dick Leahy, who talks in this book as well. And they get sent off on lots of club night performances where they can perform Wham Rap and Young Guns and their amazing formation dancing with Shirley and DC Lee. And I think they're quite humiliated at doing these club PAs because they say a lot of them don't have stages, they just have dance floors. So like literally everybody's having a great time and then all of a sudden they've got to make space for these kids to come out and do some formation dancing and mime to their songs.
Yeah.
And actually what George says in this book is that the crowd would be so drunk and because there was no stage, they would come up and manhandle Shirley and DC Lee, and he said it just got really obnoxious.
They got sort of pissed off because they were thinking this isn't helping our record sales, but then afterwards they realized that it taught them their trade.
Yes.
Like if you can learn to dance and cope with all of this, then you can do it anywhere. Top of the Pops is going to seem like a day in the park.
I think their debut on Top of the Pops is sensational. And after reading this book, I realized it wouldn't have been sensational had they not had to go and do all those appalling club nights.
Totally. It gave them confidence in their performance.
And they nailed that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's training. They're clever, these people.
Yeah. So they are doing these awful club dates, but they have a record deal. And Wham Rap is actually released as a single first, but it gets number 105. And that's kind of okay because a lot of debut singles do flop and they know they've got Young Guns coming out next, which is an all-time classic. So they release that. And it does kind of okay, but when it gets to around number 50, it begins to go back down the charts. And they're just like, oh no, the second single can't flop. Anyway, it's that whole twist of fate things that we know happened with Culture Club.
But first, oh, sorry, go on. Dick, he leaving. Really pushed it.
Dick like, got behind it.
Yeah. No, he really pushes the record on the radio and makes record shops sell it.
In store. No, yes. He makes them play it in
the
store.
Shops. Yeah. Yeah, so when people come in looking for record, they're hearing it in the record shops.
Yeah, he said, you can have it played on the radio, but 95% of people listening to the radio don't buy records.
Yeah.
He said, if you get it played inside a record shop, 100% of the people in record shops are there to record buy buyers. Record. Yeah.
Exactly.
That was very
so
clever.
So that was very good. Yeah. So he got it back up to number 42, and they just decided to put them on because it was a good act.
And
a fun act.
The producer at Top of the Pops had seen them on Saturday Superstore the weekend before and saw their fantastic formation dancing and said, this is going to look great on Top of the Pops.
So it's all because of the fantastic formation dancing.
Is it formation dancing? Is that what you call it? Or is that country dancing? Okay. It's fantastic dancing.
Yeah, it was.
Let's call it fantastic dancing.
Well, it's one fantastic.
Hey. And then that's where the big break starts to begin because that performance on Top of the Pops is fantastic and it shoots right up the charts and there's no stopping them.
No, there really is not.
And George is constantly writing over this period, new songs and stuff, right? And Andrew co-wrote the first few songs. But once their career started going, Andrew was kind of asked to step back from the songwriting.
Yeah.
And he seems to be okay with it.
Yeah, this is the same in his book. We were trying to decipher if he was really okay. In this one, he's a different character in this one. He swears more for a start. He seems a lot more honest. I think he's just being interviewed. Whereas in that book, his book, he's more formal, isn't he?
Well, he's older in his book, so perhaps
so he's more cocky then.
Yeah.
Let's face it, right? Okay, so Andrew got a bad rap, or wham rap, for being drunk all the time, and the press were always following him, and he was really drunk in clubs. But all the different people in this book say, so was George. But the press just didn't go after him.
Yeah. I think the publisher said, the press decided that Andrew was a playboy and George was the sober one.
Yeah, and they just went for that. Saying that, though, George was a grafter. And that Andrew was lazy, says every single person in
including
this book.
Andrew.
Which, yeah.
He does. He calls himself
lazy.
He does.
But I almost started wondering whether it's just because he's been bullied into thinking he is. It's quite harsh the way everyone says. They said they picked on him all the time, said, you're lazy, you know. Eventually you're going to think you are.
I think it's just the things that he was good at. I totally support the idea that when you're in a pop band, especially a duo, there's lots of complaints about pop stars and bands that they don't have time to write their next album because they're always touring or they're always having to do PA and stuff. Actually, what was good about Wham is that George was quietly writing stuff and Andrew had such an obnoxious celebrity lifestyle that he was filling all the tabloid pages with his antics. So Wham were actually constantly in the press through Andrew and George was working and writing the songs.
He was out dancing and having fun as well, of course, but he just didn't go as far as Andrew. He said, actually, there's only once where he really got so drunk he completely lost control, whereas Andrew got like that all the time. Yeah, but I mean, also, Andrew was really obsessed with pulling women. The girls' side of it was massive for him, whereas, as we know, this book says a lot, oh, George was pulling women, George was this. Was he, though, or was he actually not? And
telling people he was.
I don't know.
Because I don't know why that's in this book if he wasn't, because what this book does say is that they were both shagging a lot of women.
Yes.
But George felt uncomfortable with it because he realised that he was being used, but also he was using the women. And he said Andrew didn't care about being used. He was just there for the good time.
Yeah.
And so it weighed heavier on George.
Yeah.
And then I kind of thought maybe that was just George's way of explaining himself out of a situation that he didn't want to discuss. But I'm sure in Andrew's book, he says that George told him he was gay when they were 17.
He did. He said it really early on. And I do have a secret friend I will not name who was in a band in the 80s who told me that George Michael was sleeping with one of their bandmates, a man. So they were in a relationship of sorts. So, you know, it's like, was he sleeping with all the girls, or have they just totally and utterly made that up? So he was actively gay, and it was a big secret, but within that music industry, that was happening. And they, you know, they're, in their world, it was known.
Right.
So
it's difficult to know. Like, this book came out in, what, 1990, and obviously his manager at the time may have wanted to maintain the line that he was a ladies' man.
Oh, yeah.
Even if he was a respectful one who didn't want to shag all the groupies,
well,
we still have to put a few lines in about him shagging women.
But there's quite a few different times. And it comes and goes. There's another time where he said, at this point, George was fucking anything that moved. Air hostesses, groupies, anybody. He just didn't care. And, you know, so there's lots of different times where this comes up. And you're like, okay, do we have to just switch women for men? And then that's the true story? Or
is it just invented?
Or have you invented the whole thing? It's impossible to know.
It is impossible to know. And it's also quite a unique experience as a young man to be thrust into worldwide fame and have millions of girls screaming at them. You know, you react in different ways. Maybe he did.
Yeah, well, he's never talked about that side of it retrospectively, has he? Did he? He's talked about his adult life.
Yeah.
Openly. He hasn't really gone back and addressed his youth, did he, when he was alive in interviews?
I would never really listen to many interviews of him, to be honest.
I found him really intelligent. He's very political as well. Yeah, he's pretty sharp.
Oh, surprisingly so, because I think Wham threw you off the kind of, because it was so lively and poppy.
Yeah.
I think it did throw you off how serious and political he was, actually.
Exactly. Yeah.
And how really into music he was, and how he could really talk about music.
Yeah. But, you know, even Young Guns, it might sound light and poppy, but it's talking about being on the dole.
It's political commentary, also, social commentary,
It is. It might be light, but it's there.
I think that's the best way to write a political song.
I reckon.
Like the Trojan Horse.
Yeah.
So, three massive hit singles, Wham Rap, Young Guns and Bad Boys, and then Club Tropicana is coming out. But now they have this massive success and the album's not quite out yet. They think this is a good time to renegotiate that shit deal they had. But they still don't have a manager. And so, I forgot this, but they get Jazz Summers, who is the husband of Yaz, the pop star.
That's ridiculous that people with those names marry.
Yaz and Jazz. Yeah. Jazz Summers had been after Wham since the beginning. He'd heard about them a couple of times from different people. By the time he actually got through to someone and said, I'd like to manage them, they said, they're too big for you now. You're not a big time manager. Mm. So he had to find somebody else to co-manage them with. And that happened to be Simon Napier Bell, who was a manager of some pedigree, but he was almost over managing and didn't want to manage Wham, but Jazz talked him into it, so they kind of co-managed.
He almost said, you can be a silent partner, I just need your name, but he ended up being very pivotal in what actually happened to them.
Yeah, he was.
I think he said, I didn't want to manage anymore after Japan split up.
That's
so his
right.
His last band was Japan. They were probably a massive pain in the arse.
Yeah, they looked it, didn't they?
And then he gets this, says it'll be a ghost manager, and then really gets the adrenaline back for it.
Then, with the might of Simon Napier Bell, basically, they get them out of the contract with Mark Dean and Innervision Records. And it all seems to be going ahead amicably. Then right at the last minute, Mark Dean says, no, actually, I'm pulling out. I'm going to hold you to the contract.
Yeah, that's where it goes horribly wrong, because he said at that point they were offering a really reasonable way out where Wham would get a decent payoff and Mark Dean would have got a really good deal out of it as well. And then at the last minute he says, no, actually, I've got a contract. Stuff you, because he thinks that's legally binding. And so he ends up losing everything because of that. Just greed. That's a really bad move. But as they say, he isn't much older than them. He was 21.
Yeah, and he was on a shit deal with CBS Records as well. So, also, in fairness to George and Andrew, the managers said to them, you can go in really brutally, actually, and get out of this very easily. And they both said, no, Mark Dean was the only person who took a risk on us. Yeah. And he did make us famous. We're loyal to him.
Yeah.
And we don't want to, like, rip him off in the court. That's why they presented him with this good deal.
Yeah.
And then even with that, Mark Dean at the last minute said, no way, I'm holding you to it. Shot himself in the foot, ended up with nothing. Of course, since then, Wham become globally famous.
Yeah.
Said he felt sick every time a Wham record came on the radio.
Every ninth minute.
Yes. Oh, dear.
to this day, last bloody Christmas.
Oh my God. You know, Whamageddon.
Oh my God.
That's every day for Mark Dean. Oh, darn
it. His whole life is Whamageddon.
Anyway, so got out of that deal. CBS Records also have Epic Records, and they signed Wham to Epic to fund the next massive album, Make It Big, with the classic songs Wake Me Up Before You Go Go,
yeah,
and Freedom. And Careless Whisper, right?
Oh, so many great songs on that album. So many. Yes.
Would you say they're the biggest band in English pop at this moment in time? We've got Culture Club, Duran Duran. I always felt that Wham was slightly outside of the rivalry of Spandau, Duran and Culture Club, because they were like bands and Wham were a duo.
Yeah, and he said when he went to Do They Know It's Christmas, he felt like they were still mocked because they weren't serious, because they just,
right,
when they went on tour, they were in sports gear. They were literally in shorts,
yeah,
and put shuttlecocks down, you know, down, yeah, their shorts. And they kind of weren't taken seriously.
I wonder if that had something to do with Andrew being so prevalent in the press of just being this.
Probably partly the press.
Yeah.
Probably just partly how they displayed themselves. Where if you look at Duran Duran, that's a serious boy band, man band. But he does say he really enjoyed the rivalry, and every time they,
yeah,
pushed him off number one, he was,
and
happy.
Actually, yeah, because George lasted so much longer than those bands, he actually became sad when those bands and like Frankie Goes, yeah, to Hollywood started becoming less successful because he had nobody to fight with in the,
yeah,
charts anymore. He saw it as a big competition.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Enjoyable one.
So, oh, at this point, George has become the actual songwriter now, but he's also producing. So he's been sitting in all the sessions and learning production because he has, like you say, he was on the bus hearing the sax line to Careless Whisper.
They sent him off to America to go to Jerry Wexler at Muscle Shoals to try and recreate that soul sound that, mm-hmm, he loved. But when he came back, it wasn't right. It wasn't how he wanted it. And then George Michael had to take it back into the studio and reproduce it himself to finally get it how he wanted it. So the final product is what he did. He,
wow,
had to overproduce it over what Jerry Wexler did.
And he's still a kid at this point.
He's a kid. It is amazing every now and then when you go. And he was 22.
Yeah, yeah.
Or it blows 21 on my, yeah, or 20. I don't know. He was young.
So he's taken over producer. So by the time of the Make It Big album, George Michael is producing,
yes,
it. It's also amazing.
Learned
so
it.
I'm
so
glad that CBS and Epic have recognised his talent and letting him do this at such,
yeah,
a young age.
Definitely, yeah.
It's incredible. And so Make It Big lives up to its name, and it's a number one album in the UK and then all over Europe. So they're the biggest thing in pop.
But they hadn't broken America. So anyway, it fell onto Jazz Summers, they said. Right. Oh, because they got the manager, Freddie DeMann.
Oh, yeah. Who
Michael
did
Jackson,
Michael Jackson
and Madonna's.
Madonna.
Yeah, but they weren't really putting much effort in to break them. They had a lot going on over there, and they didn't really see them as a massive band. And it fell to Jazz Summers to make them big in America. And him and, was it Dick as well? No.
Simon Napier-Bell.
It was Simon Napier. It was the two of them, Simon Napier-Bell and Jazz Summers, got this plan together. They said, if we can get, and they've really worked on this for a couple of years, I think, if we can get Wham to be the first band to play in China ever from the West, it will make global news and then everyone will know who they are. And he ended up wangling a deal where they had to pay everything involved to get the band, the set, everything out to China. They had to pay all expenses involved while over there, of the halls, everything. They had to pay for everything. And then all the profit would go to the Chinese government as well. That's the deal they made, which is like a bad deal.
Yeah.
But they knew the long-term goal. And it's weird, actually, because I think that's how much Andrew Ridgeley was out of it. Because in this book, he said, yeah, it was a financial disaster. I think, no, it wasn't.
Long term, it wasn't.
But how can you have thought that? Do you not realise what the plan was? I'm realising,
right,
this,
yeah,
reading this book. It wasn't a financial. It cost them a million. It earned them how many millions?
Yeah.
Because they then had opened the door into America.
It's such a stroke of genius that wouldn't have occurred to most music managers, I think.
It's a wangly way around, isn't it?
Yeah, there's this massive, it was just a massive PR exercise.
Yeah.
Normally, to make it big in America, you have to go there and do extensive tours. And we already know at this point that George Michael does not like touring for very,
yeah,
long. He was never going to do it. So they had to think of a different way to break them. And,
yeah,
they're like, if they play China, they're going to be on the news 24/7 in America. He said the week before they went to China, Nobody really knew who Wham was in America. The week they came back, everybody knew
exactly
who Wham was. And that's incredible.
Yeah, I remember it being an article in Smash Hits.
Yeah, I do.
Yeah, it was so exciting for some reason. I don't think we'd ever seen China. Yeah. And they went to the Great Wall. Do you remember that?
Yes.
There's photos of them by the Great Wall.
But when you talk, because obviously there are other voices in this book, like Andrew and Shirley, they had a really horrible, depressing time. They said, ultimately, we were just going to this country where people didn't have freedom, and we were just showing them what freedom was like, and then we were leaving again, and they still had no freedom.
That's right. Here's what you could have won. And the regime had handed out both the albums so that they could listen to them in advance and know all the songs. And so they could all sing along, but they weren't allowed to dance. And Shirley says that she saw one kid lit up a cigarette and he got brutally beaten and chucked out.
Yeah.
Just really upset them. So, yeah, exactly. It's heartbreaking, they said, because you could see this hope that something was going to change, that the regime was going to change and allow them to develop culturally and stuff. But it started and finished with that gig.
And poor Shirley had to go through all of that, being depressed in China. And then when she got on the plane to fly home.
Oh, my God.
Oh, my God. That was terrifying. So she said when they were leaving, she said, was he the saxophonist
trumpet
or something?
Player,
trumpet player, Raoul. She said he'd begun behaving a bit odd. And as they were leaving the hotel, she could hear him shouting in his room, something like, I'm being possessed by the devil. And Pepsi is like, come on, Cheryl, let's just get onto the plane. And she said they got onto the plane. Pepsi's by the window, Shirley's got the middle seat, and there's one seat empty next to her, and she sees Raoul coming onto the plane, and she's like, please don't sit next to me. But of course, he sits next to her, starts beginning to be a bit weird, looking in a book and saying to Shirley, look at all these flowers, aren't they pretty? And she's like, there's no flowers there, but I'm going to pretend there are. Yes, the flowers are pretty, ha ha ha. And he just begins to get increasingly weird, and she tries to wake Pepsi up, and Pepsi's like, get over it. And then Raoul gets a knife out and starts stabbing himself. Which, of course, Shirley's terrified. She says Pepsi wakes up, realizes what's going on, and just starts screaming hysterically. Shirley says the next thing, people are leaping on Raoul. And the next thing she knows, her and Pepsi are in the next row, sat on George Michael's mum's lap. So it was like chaos in mid-air. Terrifying, I'm sure.
Yeah. That's a nice end to a trip to communist China. I think the whole thing really shocked a lot of them. Bit of a wake-up call.
But Wham weren't on that plane, were they? George and Andrew, they were on another plane. They'd gone ahead because they were travelling like royalty and the band were following up. But anyway, none of that matters because Wham are arguably the biggest pop band on the planet.
Well, they've done it. Yeah, it paid off. Then they set up a tour in America, but because George didn't want a tour, they went for stadiums. Oh, this must be a bit of a breakthrough then in the 80s to hit stadiums, because it was because of George not wanting to tour. And they'd found out, where are the album sales the biggest? San Francisco, LA, Miami, New York, you know, the classics, and then gone to them and booked the stadiums there.
And also, interestingly, MTV was beginning, and because Wham were quite visual, they also found out which cities had the highest concentration of, like, cable TV and satellite dishes.
Right.
So they married all that information together and thought, these are our best bets to leapfrog to the stadiums.
Yeah.
And it worked.
Totally sold out. Massive hysteria.
This really is, like, with that China thing, like, just from the terms of pop music management, that whole China thing was a masterstroke and PR genius. And now this idea of leapfrogging a band from small venues right up to the stadiums, which people play when they've been in the career for 25 years, but figuring out which ones they would probably sell out.
Yeah.
It's incredible. It's such good management.
It is, actually.
Yeah.
Especially when your person doesn't want a tour. You can just hit it and quit, as James Brown likes to say.
So George doesn't want to tour. And he's continuing to write songs, which he is realizing don't necessarily suit Wham anymore, but they suit him as a solo singer. Mm. So he's putting out word that actually he'd like Wham to end and that he would like to continue. This doesn't happen straight away.
Yeah, it's hard to know where this real pull away from Wham is, whether it's about him personally wanting to evolve or musically, or are they both at one and the same thing?
I think he thinks that the songs that he's writing are kind of maturing away from Wham. Mm. I think that kind of does Wham a disservice because some of those songs, especially towards the end, are actually real.
Careless
Whisper, Everything
She Wants.
And Edge of Heaven as well is a real kind of grown-up pop song.
Yeah.
You know?
So they could have evolved together. It's just that it was George's work and he doesn't need a dancing man next to him or a guitar. You know,
I think you're right. And I also think if he doesn't want to tour on that anymore, it's kind of like he probably thinks he just wants to be this studio-based person. He doesn't really, if Andrew's not part of that, Andrew's part of Wham, but George really wants to disappear into the studio, smoke his spliffs and write his songs, in which case Andrew isn't needed.
Yeah, also, Andrew was loving all the women shouting and all the adoration, whereas the adoration for George was fake. Now, he can't say that in this book because he's undercover, but actually, that might be where it's all going wrong for him, because all these women are in love with him. And so when he's playing, that's all he sees, a sea of women screaming at him. And that might be where it's just really, really not gelling and he feels really fake.
He also says when he was deciding to split from Andrew, he says, I was in the middle of a very heavy depression.
Yeah.
So that, obviously, we know what ultimately happens to him. And that became more and more apparent as he got older. Mm. He's had that his whole life then.
Yeah. Don't forget as well, he's been drinking through this whole thing right from the start, right from being young. They were drunk. Plus then he says he did do drugs. He was taking a lot of E. So you've always got downers. You're drinking, you know. Plus he's a closet that will drive anyone mad if you've got billions of girls chasing you and you're hiding.
And also the world's press are scrutinising you.
And you've got the press after you, and you've got a big secret, which must be an actual nightmare. And then we must not forget, this is coming up to about 1986-87, the AIDS epidemic is huge at this point. It's been in America more than Britain first, where they are in America anyway. It's come to Britain, because he actually says in this book, I don't actually at this point know anybody who's died of AIDS, but I'm sure I will. He's writing this book in 1990. Of course, he will then know tons. I mean, Freddie Mercury only died a year later and they were really good friends. That's how fresh that all is. But that really reminds me, we mustn't forget, because we were there, we mustn't forget the prejudice that went with that. That cannot not be factored into this, because people were afraid to touch people with AIDS, you know. People were ostracised who had it. It was a gay disease. It was, you know, oh, they deserved it. They're promiscuous. Blah, blah, blah. All of that was happening right when he wrote this book. So to come out now in this era we're in is completely and utterly different from being right in the middle of an AIDS epidemic. That was,
And thinking about it, there were no pop stars at his level or even under his level who were out gay men in the 1980s. There were some people who you thought might be, and there were smaller bands like Bronski Beat who were very much
and political
out
with it.
But there was nobody at the level of George Michael's fame
A woman icon that his sales almost depended on him being a sex symbol for women.
Having lived in the 80s, I would absolutely say if he came out of gay it would have killed his career overnight.
So I've got to give him all of that.
Yep.
And the poor bloke. So you've got this massive secret. You've got the press after you. You're trying to have a private life. One of the reasons he said he got massively depressed is that exact time is because a relationship he'd started to have collapsed because they couldn't handle the weight of his fame.
Yeah.
There's so much he's not saying with that, but, you know, the secrecy on top of it all, you know, you can imagine how he really wants love. He wants a relationship. This casual sex stuff, he says, is not doing it for him. What he really wants is a loving relationship to explore all that monogamously.
Yeah.
And he writes a song. He writes a song about that.
Do you know what? See, this is something I never, ever knew. When I Want Your Sex came out, you look at that, you take it at face value. I Want Your Sex. You think this is actually a song about promiscuity and stuff.
No, I didn't.
Did you
I
not?
I had that album. I played it to death. I knew exactly
really?
What it was about.
Yeah. It's a real revelation to me to know that that song is about monogamy and about finding your partner sexually attractive constantly and not getting fed up with them and I had no idea.
I was of an age, so I learned a lot through that song.
What we've glossed over now is the breakup of Wham, but we talked about it in the Andrew podcast.
Yeah.
So they had the big final gig at Wembley Arena, which still a sticking point with George. He only did one gig. They could have sold tickets for 10. He should have done 10.
But he was very, very depressed.
He was very depressed.
We didn't realise quite how low he was until we did this book.
It's true, but he still could have done 10 for the fans and for Andrew.
Could. I get the sense that he just literally just could not go on.
Mm-hmm.
Like possibly suicidal, you know.
Hey, now, do you remember, if I can remember back to the Andrew book, At the end of the final gig, they hugged and George Michael said to Andrew Ridgeley, I couldn't have done any of this without you.
What did he say? I couldn't have done it without you.
I couldn't have done it without you.
Because we took umbrage at this.
We did.
Yeah.
Now, did you take umbrage with a line in this book at this time?
What did he say? Because he didn't say that in this book.
He didn't say that in this book. But in this book, when he's talking about the end of Wham, he really pays tribute to Andrew. He says he totally shaped my life. Yeah. Don't listen to anybody who says he wasn't an important part of Wham. I was so lucky to find somebody so strong and so generous to give it over and let me continue and let it happen. He said, I was so grateful to meet somebody and to become a huge double act, which was really mine.
Oh.
Wow. So in a way, he's saying Andrew was so important, but actually Wham was always mine.
Yeah.
I kind of just felt a bit like...
Yeah, because it was Andrew who said, no, we're putting a band together now.
And yeah.
He wanted to wait till 2 more years after his A-level. He said, no. So I guess it was his work. It was his work. It's his songwriting.
No, I get what he's saying, but at the same time, the way he says it, this and the thing he said
you're
to Andrew is just a bit like...
giving him a compliment and then taking it right away on the last word.
Yeah. Anyway... I mean, I think to be that a massive star like that, you have to have a certain amount of arrogance and selfishness, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah.
So anyway, sorry. So go back to the Andrew podcast if you want to listen to more about the final and stuff.
Yeah, exactly.
So back to Faith.
Funny thing is, he breaks up with Wham, goes out on his own and dresses more, to be honest, a little bit more like a sort of gay icon with his leather jacket and, you know, the leather and studs is where you're at. And probably thinks it'll change maybe his audience, but it doesn't.
No.
All the women still absolutely love him. So he hasn't really changed anything. He definitely intended to.
I think when you're a teeny bop star and you have 8-year-old and 9-year-old girls screaming at you, I think they're so loyal, I think they never leave you for the rest of your life.
Also, you're still incredibly attractive to women. Yeah, he does look... He said he had an earring and he put pearls... I saw an interview where he was going, I tried to show I was a little bit gay. I got my earring and my pearls on my jacket and no one noticed.
In this book, he says he wanted to soften the macho look by putting a string of pearls. He doesn't, like, say it's gay.
Oh, yeah.
But that is a thought process that's in this book.
Oh, yeah.
Because, actually, interestingly, that whole Faith iconic look, Andrew in this book says we were really surprised that this was his choice when he went solo because it was so far removed from the George that we knew.
Yeah. Whereas he said that's his choice of clothes when he went out and it really wasn't much different.
Mm.
And because he didn't change... that much, and he just was felt really normal, and he sees all the other pop stars like Prince and Madonna and Michael Jackson so dressed up. He said he thought he'd sell albums because the music was good, but he didn't think that his pop star persona would be anything much because he felt so kind of ordinary in what he was wearing.
It was, I get what he's saying, and that essentially he is wearing jeans, a t-shirt and a leather jacket. But at the same time, that can be in itself an iconic look. Because when you think about Bruce Springsteen and Born in the USA, all he was wearing was denim, jeans and a white shirt. And that was an iconic look.
Yeah, and as it says in this book, it's very James Dean, very Brando, you know. It's classic man's man.
He thinks that he doesn't have a strong image, but actually it's a very strong, iconic image.
It is.
Yeah.
Yeah. But you know what? Because Freedom 90, which is comes in at the end of this book, classic. All the words he says, which I've listened to for years now and forgotten the timeline, because he's saying, I couldn't be every schoolgirl's fantasy anymore. Someone else I have to be. All these years I've listened to it thinking, oh, it's because he couldn't be the straight man anymore. He needed to come out. And I didn't realise it was 8 years before he got outed in LA. And if he hadn't been outed, it might have been longer. So that's a hell of a time to carry that. He's being someone else in public and that.
That whole withdrawal from public life and deciding after Faith and being at odds with the image he had created. When you think about George Michael, after he hung up the leather jacket from Faith, if you look at him, from that point till the day he died, he basically always dressed the same.
All right.
It was just very plain black suit. Yeah. And sometimes he would wear specs. And his hair and beard, I think, were basically always cut the same. He wanted it all to be about the music.
Yes.
He didn't want to get absorbed with the image. But I also think part of that and withdrawing from public life is maybe being worried if you do too much or give too much that they're going to find out you're gay, maybe.
That's right. I know. Well, I worry about him, and rightly so, because now he's dead and he was only 61.
Was he even that old?
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe not even that old, but I can't help but worry that all of that, the tension and the worry. I mean, it's just the time he lived in I just feel so sad about it, that he had to go through all of that and hide himself like that, and all the anxiety and all the problems that caused. And how lucky it is for the bands now that can just come out. And
Yeah, but they can do that because of him.
I know, that's so true. Not that he came out on purpose, but...
No, but it's the way he handled it afterwards.
He handled it so
well. He went straight on to talk shows and he was... that happened.
Yeah, he just... owned it. I mean,
like somebody else maybe would have married Liza Minnelli to throw us off the scent. Do you know what I mean? But George Michael totally was like, yeah, here I am. I'm a gay man.
Yeah, and actually it's a relief to come out. And actually my friends know, and anyone who's in this situation knows, those are the most important people. And after that, he did. He really owned it.
So George, now as a solo star, is massive.
But the shame of it all is that he became even more
isolated. Yeah. To the point, when he was on tour, he would fly out his childhood friends and his family so he could hang out with them. But because it was such a tight ship and he was making so much money, the visitors, would be bullied by his security guards. And when they came to visit, they would say to them, do not take George out drinking tonight. Look after him. Make sure he doesn't smoke. Make sure he doesn't do drugs. They would read them the Riot Act. Yeah. And George Michael is like... they're not forcing me to go out. I want to go out and enjoy myself. But then his team aren't even letting him go out and enjoy himself.
And then everyone feels awkward around him.
Yeah. One of his friends in this book says it got to the point where he actually saw a security guard manhandling his mum and his sister. Yeah. So that's how much they were keeping people away from George. So one of his problems is isolation. But unfortunately, one of the side effects of massive fame when you're making literally millions of pounds every night
is the cash cow, aren't you?
Yeah, people are keeping people away from you because you have to do your job.
Britney.
There we go. Yeah. Yeah. So, Faith, biggest LP of the year, Grammy best album. I mean, wow, his career is just as big as it's ever going to be. But here's an interesting thing. He's such a studio person. The one thing I hate about when somebody is massively famous, because it's a thing most people dream of, I hate it when they complain. And there's another quote in this book which really surprised me. But I think it just tells you why George doesn't like touring. And he says, when you're on tour, your life is on ice. It's a missing period. It literally takes a time out of your life and nothing happens. It's a sacrifice. It's just like, oh my God, get me on a world tour singing to people every night, please. It's what most people dream of.
Oh, it's because he doesn't like it. What he says, though, is in that first week, you've got the buzz of the audience, you're singing them the songs, you're connected with them. It's amazing. The second night, it's amazing. By the end of the week, there's nothing more you're going to get from doing that 82 more times. You've had that experience in 1 week. That's all you need. After that, you're just repeating the experience.
I'm really sad to hear that. Do you think other people who do massive tours then, like Michael Jackson and Madonna, do you think they have a similar experience?
I think they have good nights and bad nights, but they've all got to pretend they're all good nights. I think they really enjoy a load of them. It depends. If it's some rock bands that are all on drugs, they can barely track themselves on stage. It's different for everybody, isn't it?
And again, like we said, Michael Jackson and Madonna are dancers. They're performers. They're the whole thing. So they like being on stage as much as George Michael probably likes being tucked away in the studio.
Exactly. They need that buzz from the audience. Yeah. Whereas George Michael doesn't need the live experience. Yeah, he loves to create the songs.
And he says you can't write on tour. So he does. He just wants to be in the studio.
Exactly. He's a creator. He's not a churner or a repetition man. This does make sense.
So, you know, going back to Shirley from Wham, here's another thing that we found out through the Andrew book. He left Wham and went off to be a massive solo star. But actually, him and Andrew are still very good friends and they do still see each other. And there's no hard grudges there or anything. Shirley from Wham, they do keep in touch, but she's distanced herself and she's more worried about George than Andrew ever is. Mm. And one night she dreams that he died.
Yes.
I know it took another 30 years for him to die, but I think that's quite telling that somebody who knew him and was part of that circle was already worried about him.
Yeah.
In 1990.
You're right. It was weird reading that actually, even though he had years to go.
And he's 26 at the end of this book.
But how many different people, every single contributor almost, says at one point he's an old soul?
Yeah.
Everyone says it. And you do get that sense.
I do get that. He's a lot more serious than you would imagine. Yeah. I think the Wham persona belies that because he's jumping around, waking me up before
well,
you go.
Wham
go.
Does,
it looks
but George
fun.
Michael
no,
does not.
No, for sure.
The burdens he's carrying are all in his music. If you really want to know George Michael, you only have to listen to his songs. It's all in there.
But do you know what? If you want to know George Michael, that did you think the last paragraph in the book was just so sad? Because he talks about relationships again. Mm. So basically the last bit this man says in his autobiography is like he's had to come to terms with the fact that he's probably never going to have a proper loving relationship because nobody can get past the George Michael of it all, yeah. The superstar. And he says that even if somebody does get to know him, he's still going to be George Michael to them. And the last line of the book is, I can't take that because I feel a very great need to get away from George Michael most of the time.
Yeah.
Wow.
That's because George Michael's a made-up name, he's yeah. a made-up character, and he's just Yorgos.
Panayotti. Or Yorg. Yeah, Yorg.
Call him Yorg.
Yeah.
So he's got one of those dual personality issues. There's a real him that he can't even be.
The thing about that is that historically, lots of people, Beyonce, David Bowie, all of them have their on-screen, a lot of them give them different names, on-screen, sorry, yes. that on-stage persona, for that very purpose that
That's
they
right.
can divide
they can separate.
It.
Yeah, but his other person had to be secret.
Right.
It has to be to do with that, doesn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah.
He had to even keep it secret from his parents mm-hmm. for a long, long time. There's a third person, isn't there?
Yeah, right.
It's not just two.
Poor George. I kind of... It's a difficult one because it's almost as much as the era. You know, we thought the 80s were so progressive and they were to a certain extent. But for someone like George Michael, it was pretty much like being a gay movie star in the 1950s yeah. Hollywood, right?
And you know what they all knew about him? You know, obviously Elton John and Freddie and all those because they were all secretly gay as well. Boy George, you know, but they all knew that whole within that world, they all knew. So it's amazing to have an open secret like that. But nobody outed him. You just wouldn't do that.
Boy George tried to a few times.
Did he?
Yeah, he really did. I was personally shocked by the death of George Michael, perhaps because I hadn't seen him on stage singing recently or anything. Mm-hmm. And it happened around Christmas. Was it on Christmas Day?
I think it was Boxing Day.
Boxing Day.
It was the year of death. It was 2016, the year everybody died,
mm-hmm.
beginning with Bowie and Alan Rickman, you know, and it went right through. Prince killed me. It was that year. And then Christmas Day, oh my God, I think Princess Leia, Carrie Fisher.
Right, uh-huh.
And then the next, I was like, can we just finish this year, please? No, apparently not. You've got to give us that on Christmas Day. You've got to give us George Michael on Boxing Day. I was like, no, please, no.
God, just don't be famous. We're learning this a lot in these books.
I mean, some people can handle it differently. Classic, be careful what you wish for, because you don't understand what it is you wish for. If you spent every week reading an autobiography for a year,
yeah.
you might not wish for it.
Yeah.
Because you'd have learned what we've learned. But you might still, but at least you'd know what you were doing. Mm-hmm. None of these people know what they're going into. No clue.
And it is not an answer to any existing problems.
It will not fill the hole in yeah. your soul. We know that much. Just creates whole new holes. Whole new holes.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Thrift Shop Biography. We love making this podcast and we're absolutely thrilled that so many of you are already listening. We're new to this and you could really help us out by leaving us a review somewhere, wherever you listen to this podcast. And if you could share us, tell your friends about us or drop some links on social media. We have a Facebook page called Thrift Shop Biography. So make sure you come over there to hear about the episodes first and what else we're up to. Okay, see you next week. And if you're new here, there are loads more episodes now to go and listen in the back catalogue. So make sure you go and enjoy them. Okay, thank you very much. Bye.